What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin. This is Quo Vadimus. I got Seth Partnow on the line today, the editor of Nylon Calculus, our HP Basketball Network site. Seth, what's up, man?
How's it going?
Not too bad. You know, just relaxing on this Friday morning. We're going to try something new this week and every week, hopefully, for the rest of the season. We're going to talk about the two TNT games played last night from a numbers and strategy perspective, get a little bit nerdy. The two games last night were the Thunder against the Bulls and the Grizzlies against the Blazers. Because there's a little bit less to talk about from that game, given that it was a blowout, we're going to start with Grizzlies-Blazers, even though it was the late game. There was, you know, I watched these games time shifted on DVR because I had some stuff to do for NFL and CBS last night. There was a whole lot of consternation on Twitter about the Grizzlies that I saw. So I was expecting them, when I watched the game this morning on DVR, to just get blown out right from the start. That is not what happened at all. Basically, this game was tied with 7:03 left in the third quarter at 62. And then over the final 7:03 of the third, Portland went on a 28-9 run to end that quarter, which basically provided the entire margin of victory for the game. I think it's a little bit unwarranted for people to have been flipping out the way they did, because basically they just got outplayed by a whole lot over a 7-minute stretch, as opposed to this being a game where they really weren't in it at all.
Yes and no. I think if it was just this one game that people were kind of freaking out about, that would be one thing. But considering they've already, you know, lost by 50 and 30 in other games, that and just giving up these kind of avalanche like runs, you know, it's possible that it's they've come up one after another by happenstance. But that's something to worry about, and that's. And that was really it. I mean, I think it was an avalanche, because it just seemed like every time you looked up, the Blazers were hitting a three or getting a layup, and that kind of that second half of the third quarter, and that's worrisome in itself, in the fact that it was just a complete, I don't want to say collapse, but for that stretch, it was non-competitive, and some of that is, you know. Portland is going to look great on nights where, you know, Lillard and McCollum are hitting pull-up jump shots over everybody, and you can't overreact to tough shots going in too much. But if it's something that keeps happening, then it's a worry.
You brought up the point of the runs, and I noticed that too, because obviously that was, you know, the 28-9 run to end the quarter. So I got myself to thinking, like, maybe the fact that Memphis's offense goes so cold sometimes, you know, maybe they are, you know, unusually susceptible to having runs against them. And then I remembered that you did that post for Nylon Calculus last year based off a question that I asked you about, you know, 7-0 runs and 10-0 runs. And I looked at it. Memphis actually allowed the third fewest 7-0 or more runs last season. Only San Antonio and Toronto allowed less. You know, some of that I would imagine has to do with the fact that they play slower, but, you know, they had a 30 run advantage in terms of them having, they had 174 7-0 runs last season and allowed 144. When you got into 10-0, they fared a little bit worse. They allowed 33, but only had 30 of their own. But basically what I'm saying is the runs thing, you know, maybe they weren't as susceptible to it last season, but that could obviously change this year. We only have 1 year of data on it. We have no idea how consistent it is.
No, sorry. I think, you know, it's, someone made the comparison last night on Twitter that, Mike Conley had some quotes about their defense that were reminiscent of kind of Fibs quotes last year about Chicago, and think, you know, what you're mentioning there and kind of what we're seeing now is they're a team that didn't have a great margin for error, just because in part of their clunky offense. And so if their defense has in fact slipped a little, and whether it's by, you know, personnel combinations or certain guys getting a little bit older and less effective, that's a problem for this team that was kind of always on the edge of toppling over because of their offensive issues.
Right. If they're a 8th to 14th ranked defense rather than the top five they've been for the entirety of the grit and grind era, then all of a sudden the fact that they're, you know, a slightly above to slightly below average offense takes them from a 50-plus win team to a mid-40s win team, probably.
Yeah, and, you know, they're up and down the roster. This is, maybe some of this is just a matchup thing, is Portland was significantly more athletic than them all over the court. And you know, you saw it with especially, it seemed like with all night Portland's bigs, whether it was Mason Plumlee or Myers Leonard or Ed Davis, were just significantly more mobile, and that seemed to create a lot of problems and give Portland a lot of openings, kind of for you know, rolls to the basket, even off of kind of broken floor plays and follow ups and tip dunks and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought that up, because I was going to bring up the same thing. It was very noticeable just how much more sheer athleticism the Blazers have than Memphis does. Everybody on Memphis, basically except Brandon Wright, plays their game almost entirely below the rim. They have none of that sort of vertical spacing that you talk about with a guy like Tyson Chandler, DeAndre Jordan, Andre Drummond. Everybody's below the rim. So not only do they have sort of a horizontal spacing problem with their lack of shooting, they don't really have anybody that, you know, is knifing through the paint on pick and rolls and drawing guys inside all over the place. They do it a little bit differently with their post-ups for Zebo and Mark. But, you know, you watch those plays, and especially in this game, the Blazers were content to dig down into the post every single time with just no concern at all that anybody's going to make them pay from outside.
And I think that's something that's sort of characterized Terry Stotts' coaching tenure, is defensively they're almost, I think this is a point Nate Duncan likes to make in other contexts, but they're almost a European style in that they will be very, this is going to be phrased weirdly, but they're very aggressive at conceding the shots they want to concede and not worrying about the outcome in the short term. So, in you look at Memphis. All right, don't let them beat you up inside. They can't beat you. So let's dig down hard and not really worry about anything else. And you know, on a game where Memphis, true to form, is not shooting well, that obviously works great. But I think that that a hallmark of Terry Stotts' coaching there is that even if they had made a jump shot or two, they probably would have kept going with that strategy. And you know, again, if the opposition shoots, does the thing they do poorly, overall poorly in the game, it's going to look great. And that's a little bit of what happened last night, I think.
Right, and it's also, it's interesting that you described it as aggressive about conceding the shots they want to concede, because I think generally most people consider their defensive scheme a little bit conservative. You know, they hang back on pick and rolls, they're not necessarily going to jump passing lanes or things like that, but they will give you any mid-range shot you want, and again, against a team like this, they're just not going to let you do anything in the paint, and then they'll let you fire away from outside because they have confidence that nobody's going to make it.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to, this is something that I brought up with respect to Portland, and we're getting a little a field of this game specifically, is they were one of the teams that prediction models, them and the Celtics were the two teams that kind of metrics-based prediction models differed most greatly from kind of the Vegas odds. And I think both for similar reasons. Nathan Walker, one of the Nylon Calculus writers, talked about this on a podcast with Ian last week. It's just because there's a not having bad players and having players primed to step into bigger roles kind of means that they have some guys who are more going to be more effective this year than their name would reflect. And I think we're seeing that more so with Portland than with Boston so far. And I think to a large degree that's the influence of having that kind of one or two guys you could make things go, which Portland has in Lillard, who's been, you know, great to start the year, and Boston doesn't really have.
I think it's interesting that you said that because, you know, watching the game last night, I kept being struck by, you know, this was actually the first time I caught Portland all season. They're running, you know, basically the same plays for a new group of guys. Like, the play they ran to start the game where C.J. McCollum came up and, you know, feigned as if he was going to set a screen for Damian Lillard and then came off a back screen to go into the corner. That's something they ran for Wes Matthews and Nick Batum a lot. They're running a lot of high pick and rolls for Mason or Miles or whichever Plumlee they have, you know, like they did with Robin Lopez, and then pick and pops for Myers Leonard as they did with LaMarcus Aldridge. Not a whole lot has really changed other than the personnel, which is not necessarily something you'd expect when you change so much of the personnel.
It's true, and it's also, when you look at them player for player, it's like they don't have, for a team that kind of rebuilt on the fly, they're not actually trotting out like that many bad players. You know, people sort of snickered at Al-Farouq Aminu's contract, but even going into the season, you wouldn't have said he was a bad player. In their rotation, maybe the closest they get, depending on how you feel about him, is Alan Crabb. And that's kind of the last guy in their regular rotation. And that's, you know, you look at almost any other team in the league, and there are some guys who you have to consider, you know, negative players in their rotation. Even the Warriors, I mean, they are, you know, even while games are competitive, Leandro Barbosa is getting, you know, minutes. And, you know, it's not to say that he doesn't bring other things to the team by all accounts. There's a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes stuff that he's very helpful with. But as an on-court presence, he's, you know, would fall kind of below that line of a positive contributor. And Portland isn't necessarily, you know, giving a lot of minutes to negative players.
Right, and that's something that our esteemed editor-in-chief, Ian Levy, wrote about for The Cauldron, but in connection with Boston, where, you know, they're giving a very low percentage of minutes to negative players, and that it's easier to go from a negative player to a slightly above average player than an average player to a great player, and that the difference could be possibly worth just as much in terms of, you know, pure win production. Obviously, you know, to get into the high, high level of wins, you need those star guys, but to avoid becoming, you know, one of the worst few teams in the league, you may only really need a bunch of average or slightly above guys, and I think that Portland has that a little bit. One thing I wanted to get to before we move on to the next game, Memphis ran out their all-bench unit a little too much for me in this game. They did it early in the second quarter, and they did it for a brief period of time near the end of the third quarter. Their all-bench unit this year is shooting 38% from the field and 27% from three. That group has been Oudra, Matt Barnes, the Greens, Jeff, and Jamichael. and Brandon Wright. One thing for me is that it puts too much pressure on Jeff Green to be the Jeff Green that everybody sort of thought he would be when he was coming out of school, and which he's proven throughout his years in the league to not necessarily be. You don't really want him creating his own shot all the time. And within that group, it's got to be basically him and Beno Udrih creating everything. And that's just not a scenario that's going to work all that much. I don't know whether it should be Conley or Zebo or Mark playing sort of 1 and 4 with that unit, but I feel like they need to have one of those guys on the floor at all times, as opposed to sort of leaving it up to Jeff Green and Beno to do so much of the creating when that group is on the floor.
That's a good point, and something I've been looking at a lot recently is kind of these lineup combinations, and it's not to say one size fits all, because different teams have different mixes of talent, but I'm really not a fan of giving consistent minutes to five-man bench units, because if you look at it league-wide, once starters being a rough proxy for a team's best players, over the course of last season at least, once you get into situations where teams have 2 and 3 more starters on the opponent than the opposition, it's a pretty sizable advantage. It's with 2 or 3 starters, it's I think the advantage is probably averages out to around 4.5 points per 48 minutes of an advantage. That's a pretty giving up minutes that doesn't not necessarily sound like much, but giving up those kind of advantages consistently every game. I mean, you're basically spotting the opposition. A bucket or two every game, just on average, and that's hard to recover, especially when you're a team that has low margin of error.
Right, and the Grizzlies definitely do. There are some teams that can get away from it, that can get away with it. Like the Warriors can get away with playing their bench five altogether, or 4 of their bench guys and Harrison Barnes, as they've done with Andrew Bogut out.
Yeah,
but Memphis is. There's such a slim margin for error already, and I think you see that even with their starters on the floor, just in terms of how hard they have to work to create all their looks. And when the level of talent is not even close to what it is when the starters are on the floor, that margin for error not only shrinks or disappears, it goes completely the opposite way, where you're just giving away points against all but the worst units out there.
Yeah, and like you said, the comparison with the Warriors. The Warriors' starting unit is blowing people out, so you can kind of take a breath. And even the Clippers, who were one of the teams that consistently get kind of killed with this, their starters are so good that they don't necessarily get away with it. But they can deal with it. And Memphis' starters don't have that kind of that ability to quickly reel off, like a 15-3 run with regularity. That gives you that little bit of cushion.
Right. I mean, and it doesn't look like they do right now, but that group also has been, especially the 4 core guys with Conley, Tony Allen, Zebo, and Mark, has been one of the better units in the league over the last 4 or 5 years. So maybe that corrects itself over the rest of the season. We're only 6 games in right now. But right now, it doesn't look like they have enough to sort of build big enough leads to where playing largely bench guys on the floor all at the same time would be okay for them. But quickly before we move on to the other game, which I think is much more interesting from both a numbers and tactics standpoint, how worried are you about the Grizzlies? Because Matt Moore, our I don't even know what his title is within HP anymore, but he created it. I saw, because I watched these games on DVR last night, I saw him sort of freaking out on Twitter, sort of in slow motion, fired off like 100 tweets towards the end and then after the game, and 50 of them were in all caps. And I sent him a G-chat like, "Hey man, are you okay?" And he's like, "I don't understand why people are asking me this." And I think it was because of, sort of what we saw on Twitter, not that it's out of the normal, but he seemed to be not all that worried, whereas most of his followers were like, the sky is falling. I fall somewhere in the middle. I'm curious where you fall.
It's a little bit of confirmation bias for me because I was worried about the Grizzlies heading into the year. I actually picked Utah to finish sixth in the West, because of a combination of New Orleans injuries and the fact that I thought that this was going to be the year that Memphis fell off a little bit, and just kind of the way the season has started has done nothing to change my opinion. And you talked about kind of that core four guys. A guy like, you're looking specifically at guys like Tony Allen or Zach Randolph, and it doesn't take much slippage in their kind of primary skills for them to go from, kind of one bucket of an above average rotation player or star or something like that to a completely different one. And that changes, that's a little bit reductive, obviously, but that changes the dynamic of their team so much. If Zach Randolph is an average or maybe even slightly below starter now, the limitations that those guys bring are, self-evident in terms of, Tony Allen shooting, Zach Randolph's speed and shooting. And so if he's no longer able to just be a bully inside and stuff like that, and if Tony Allen, becomes even more of an offensive liability, all of a sudden, and his defense slips a little, all of a sudden, are they good enough to play this way anymore? And that was kind of my worry coming into the season. And again, them just getting overwhelmed by Portland's athleticism for stretches does very little to dissuade me from that concern.
Yeah,
I think they're fine. They'll be okay. They'll probably still make the playoffs. But as far as them being a top tier team at this present setup, I think that window might be over.
Yeah, I'm on board with pretty much all of that. I think that my range for them has sort of dropped into the more, 47 to 52 win range rather than 50 to 55. And that doesn't sound like much, but it's the difference between competing for a 3-4-5 seed and firmly being in the 6-7-8 range. I agree that they'll still make the playoffs, and there's not too much to be overly worried about in terms of the, a complete collapse, but I do think that starting this summer they're going to have to make some changes if they want to get back to that upper echelon. I don't think that necessarily means not bringing Mike Conley back. I would imagine him and Marc Gasol are going to sort of lead the next iteration of whatever the team is, but it's more on the Randolph and Tony Allen front, like you said. Even a little bit of slippage puts them into a completely different bucket than they've been in over the last few years. And especially when you look at the shooting that everybody else in the league is getting from those two positions in particular, and they're not, it just becomes too much of a detriment sometimes.
To beat the point into the ground, like if you are getting the other stuff from them, it maybe balances out. But if Tony Allen is an A-minus defender instead of an A-plus defender, are you still getting enough? And that's, certainly after the second half of the Golden State series last year, you kind of have to worry about that.
Right. So let's, before we move on to the actual Bulls-Thunder game, I sent you a message on GChat while I was watching on DVR.
Yeah.
In the middle of the first quarter, where I said that this might have been the worst announced game that I can ever remember. So let's just take like 3 quick minutes to bitch about the announcing of this game and then talk about the actual stuff we want to talk about. Do you want to go ahead first?
So this is a question I've wondered for a while, is why the NBA allows its flagship games to be presented in a way that is more appealing to non-basketball fans than to basketball fans. Like, if you who, if you follow the game closely, you can readily identify the ridiculousness of what was actually being said, and then the kind of the repetition of Russell Westbrook needs to pass the ball more, blah blah blah, for four quarters. Even if that point had merit, which, you know, at times maybe it does, and there's points that you made about it, but they weren't made well. Even if that's a valid point, find something else to say over four quarters. And if you're turning Reggie Miller into the voice of reason on a broadcast, there's a problem.
Yes, I would say to pretty much all of that, and especially the way that Chuck was doing it, where he'd take a shot, and then every single time it was, he needs to pass that, and then he would make a pass for an assist, and he's like, see, look how easy that was? He should do that every time. Like, I'm sure that Russell Westbrook should literally never shoot. Like, there's a way to make that point, and there's a way not to make that point, and I think that the line was very clearly crossed in the wrong direction. And it wasn't just once or even a couple times. It was literally for 48 minutes, even when he wasn't in the game. And same thing with Kevin Durant, which you'd very rarely hear that complaint about Kevin Durant. Usually it's, oh, Westbrook needs to pass to Durant more. But even Chuck was saying that Durant needs to spend more time throwing the ball to Enes Kanter in the post and identifying the mismatch with when Serge Ibaka has Doug McDermott in the post and throw it to him down there. I mean, whew. Let's have everybody run their offense like Mark Jackson, I guess.
Yeah, and I made that exact comparison. And, you know, well-known shot creator Serge Ibaka, throw him the ball and let him cook. When it was tear your hair out bad, and it I think affected my. It affected my kind of opinion of the quality of the game. I can't tell if it was my impression watching it was it wasn't an especially well played game despite being a close game. But I don't know how much of that was my kind of level of annoyance over the assault on my on my faculties that was occurring.
Yeah, I mean, I especially thought that the contrast between the way they were talking about Westbrook and the way they were talking about Rose was strange, mostly because, you know,
they play the same style, and right. Westbrook does it much better.
Right, especially now.
And then
you just, you know, so Rose would drive the basket, and they'd be like, oh, that's great, be aggressive, and then, you know, in the third quarter at one point, he made a jumper, and they're like, oh, you see that? He goes to the basket, and now his jumper goes in. That's a great job. I mean, it was not great to listen to. But unless you have more specific complaints on that front, I think I'm done with it.
It was interesting. It seemed sort of like Craig Sager was reading Twitter during the game, because there was one point they threw it to him and he's like, you guys know Russell Westbrook's leaving the NBA to assist, right?
Right, and I saw you tweeted during the game, and it's not. Like I said, I wound up watching it after, but you tweeted during the game that he's first in the NBA in assist chances this year, that SportView stat, where, you know, passes that he throws that if the shot was made would become an assist, and he was fifth last year. So it's not like he's just racking up assists because the scorers are friendly or something. He very often puts guys in a position to succeed and to make shots. And that's been true basically throughout his career. It's just something that's not true, the stuff they were saying. That's basically what it comes down to. But let's talk about some real stuff, because there was some interesting things that happened in this game.
This sort of bleeds into real stuff, I think, though, actually. It's a common complaint about Westbrook, and I think it's you know, people tend to mistake the kind of errors that he's making if they are. Like, you know, yes, you would like to clean up certain decisions and stuff like that, but the negative is, in many cases, and I was talking about it on pod with Sam Vecenie earlier this week, the negatives that come from him are kind of the price you pay for the good things that happen. Like, you want the spectacular and you know, forceful plays that he made. Sometimes they're not going to work out. And if he's not committing to the play in such a way that if it doesn't work out, it might be ugly, then the good thing isn't going to happen as much either. And the good so far outweighs the bad that when you say, you know, let Russ be Russ, it's like you're saying, okay, we have to live with these occasional, you know, blips. And they're, you know, they're more than occasional because he's on a possession-to-possession basis. He can be high variance, but over the course of a game and a season, the positive is so much better that you just have to, you know, all right, try to be slightly better about the wildest decision. But still, you have to live with that, and you have to be okay with that. And that's, you know, the complaints about him are so aesthetics-based rather than effectiveness-based.
Right, and the strange thing about it is that there were complaints to be made about Westbrook last night, and I thought they were pretty obvious. They just came on the opposite end of the floor that the announcing team wanted to focus on. You know, he was dying on screens a whole lot, jumping himself out of position. And I think we've seen both at UCLA and then with Team USA that when he's really locked in on every single possession, he can be a really, really terrific defender. But that was not the case last night. And I think it's largely been, I would say, mostly not the case throughout his career, even though he does have long spurts of very good defense. For the most part, I think he's been a slightly below average defender. But last night was particularly not good for him. And it wasn't necessarily connected to Derrick Rose having 28 points or whatever it was. And I'll have stuff to say about that later. But I thought that there was a really missed opportunity, sort of, to criticize Westbrook on defense and largely the Thunder on defense, because I think that's where they lost the game.
I think so too, and I think that it's hard to tell how much of it was Westbrook himself and how much of it was the team concept, but kind of from the second quarter on, the number of times, from really the second and the third quarter mostly, fourth quarter was a little better as Chicago's offense kind of became a cloggy mess itself. The number of times where Rose was kind of turned loose towards the basket was really surprising to see. And he's, you know, we kind of know he's a guy who's going to shoot if he drives to the basket. Using kind of the Sport View Drive statistics, among point guards, he was, you know, by a decent margin, the most likely to try to score on his drives than any player, and one of the most of any player, you know, regardless of position in the league last year, and that has only really continued this year. I mean, example is he had he had 14 drives last night to pass once.
It's so funny that you brought this up because I literally have in my notes, Rose shoots every time on the drive, bring up Sport View pass stats. And
yeah, it's something I've been looking at all year.
Yeah, he's averaging 9.3 drives a game, which is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12th most in the league, or tied for 10th most in the league. And he's passing on 17.9% of those drives, which is, I mean, by over 7%, the lowest among that group of players. It's the lowest by far among the top 30, and among the top 40, only Julius Randle is lower, I think. Every single time he's going to the basket, he's shooting.
And that's not necessarily a criticism, by the way. It's just it's a stylistic thing.
Right.
That I will say that given his physical abilities and where they are relative to his prime, if you put a body in front of him, his finishing is not what it was.
Sure. Although he did make one, classic throwback Rose layup where he sort of cuffed it on the way through the lane and then had like that little moving from left to right, that little spinny layup that he has, or had, I guess is more accurate, and broke out last night. And that was like the one thing that actually did give MVP flashbacks as opposed to almost everything else that happened in the game.
But the thing is through kind of his rough stretch before this, like he would be driving into traffic, kind of bump up against the big and just not really be able to get a quality shot over him. In the second and third quarter, especially, he beat Westbrook and then go to the rim and be nobody there. And I don't know if that was because Enes Kanter was on the floor, but I think it was because Enes Kanter was on the floor for large portions of that.
And I saw Mason Ginsburg, who writes about the Pelicans, he tweeted out sort of the three-man lineup stats from this game, and they were sorted by net rating from low to high, and you're looking at it and every single negative one included Kanter or Dion Waiters, and then every single positive one did not, and it was all Westbrook, Durant, Ibaka, Westbrook, Durant, Adams, Westbrook, Ibaka, Adams, Durant, Ibaka, Adams, and then all of the negative ones were the ones with Kanter and or Waiters involved, and the two of them were particularly brutal defensively, in addition to Westbrook, who was quite bad, I thought, as well, that really killed them in I think it was the second quarter that I made the most note of it. Just looking through my notes here, there was a whole lot of times where they were just letting guys skit sort of wherever they wanted on the floor.
Sure. Flipping sides, the Bulls started Doug McDermott tonight, or last night.
Yes.
It didn't really seem like it had much of an impact.
Right, it didn't really seem to affect the game on either end, I thought. He sort of was invisible, which is one of... it's not the worst thing you can be. The worst thing you can be is actively hurting your team, but being invisible is right next to it, and he was invisible, I thought.
He was visible a few times, mostly on defense, and mostly when he was 30 feet away from guarding his man, who was Andre...
I'm pretty sure it's Robertson, but he had one basket all night, and it came on a corner three when Westbrook ran a pick and roll with Serge Ibaka, and McDermott literally fell asleep and was standing in Westbrook's driving lane, and Westbrook just threw it across the court.
I don't think he fell asleep. I think that he said he saw Robertson spacing to the corners, like, okay, you go there, I'm going to stand right here where I know Westbrook is going, because not only I don't think you're going to make that shot, I don't even think you're going to take that shot. And that's been something that that we've been noting over the course of the year, is the number of times where he gets the ball in that, Robertson gets the ball in that exact spot and doesn't even just immediately hot potatoes it back to the corner, despite the back to the top of the key, despite there being no one within 15 feet of him. And he shot that last night and he made it. But it's, even though that shot went in, that position is a problem for Oklahoma City, and I think it kind of rears its head on, all right, that one shot went in, but every other play where the stuff they're running on the strong side is super congested because his man is wandering so far, it's a problem. I think that was kind of Oklahoma City started the game getting anything they wanted out of, some kind of side and middle pick and rolls. Ibaka had a great start to the game, just kind of taking advantage of some kind of short rolls when Chicago was icing a lot of pick and rolls. And then probably about 6 minutes into the game, Chicago seemed like they made an adjustment and brought the offside wing, right into the play, and that really kind of started to stymie OKC's offense for a while because that pop out of the short roll just wasn't there anymore.
Yeah, two things on that. I do have as one of the things to bring up was that was one of the most concerted efforts from Oklahoma City that I've ever seen to get Ibaka involved in the pick and roll. He had, on that short roll only, he had 4 baskets in the first 5 minutes of the game. And then, like you said, Chicago started bringing Robertson and then Waiters' guy into the paint to completely cut that off sort of near the free throw line, which is where, you know, Westbrook and Ibaka, when they run their pick and roll, pick and pop, whatever you want to call it, Westbrook loves to turn the corner and go full speed, and then Ibaka will sort of just float right above the free throw line. That's happened, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of times over the years that they've played together. You know who would help if teams started bringing the opposite corner guy into to cover Ibaka right there? Anthony Morrow would help. Yeah. If he's the guy getting that pass across the court, that's a three that goes in the basket rather than a shot that either doesn't get attempted or one that the guy holds it and decides to go one-on-one for a step-back two-point jumper. For some reason, Anthony Morrow played 5 minutes in this game, and it was with the group of DJ Augustine, Deion Waiters, Nick Collison, and Enes Kanter. He seems like the guy who should be playing with Durant and Westbrook, not that group of idiots. But, you know, that's just me. You might want to put one of the best shooters on the planet with those two guys. I think that would help.
I can't disagree. Maybe you worry about defensively, but I think if you're, especially if Ibaka and Adams are the big men on the floor, you can maybe make up for, and, you know, Durant can be an effective defender as well. I think whatever Morrow is giving up there, you more than make up for with the fact that third guy crashing the pick and roll either can't or can be made to pay for it much more readily with an actual shooter on that opposite side of the floor.
And especially when a guy like McDermott is out there, that's a pretty easy place to hide Morrow on defense. Obviously, they wanted to give Durant that assignment so he didn't have to work quite as hard on defense as he did offensively. You know, having him to go at Jimmy Butler on both ends would be tough. But at the point that it starts hurting you that Robertson or Waiters are out there, you got to make a switch.
And the thing is, unless you're really focusing on it, it can be kind of invisible. This is something that actually came up this summer. We're talking about, Matt Barnes with the Clippers. He shot the ball pretty well from three last year, but they still would have been better last year with a more recognized shooter in that spot because he shot the ball pretty well on wide open shots, which meant that his man was, in the paint, at the elbow areas, wherever else, kind of screwing up all the other good stuff that the Clippers do. And, that extra little bit whether Matt Barnes shoots 32% on sort of semi-contested threes or 35% on open ones, they'll give up that little bit of percentage to screw up every single other play to influence every other play the Clippers are running. And I think that's Oklahoma City kind of runs into that a little bit where, it's even within the new coaching regime, it's kind of so obvious where their offense is coming from that if you can, rotate more coverage towards those guys, it's hard to pinpoint the exact effect, but it's kind of a constant drag on their offense every possession that makes, every possession just slightly harder. And over the course of a game, that's worth, 2, 3, 4, 5 points. And how many games is that worth?
Right. And one of the ways I noticed that they actually tried to counteract it early in the second quarter was they started snaking the pick and roll, which if you don't know what that means is, as soon as you come around the screen, you cross right back over to get into the middle of the paint. So that way, it was, and then, you know, they had the big man then go sort of on a delayed roll to the basket rather than popping out. So that sort of got them access to the middle of the floor that they then weren't getting when they started cutting off those Ibaka short rolls. They did that 3 or 4 times in the first 2 minutes of the second quarter alone, and it worked fairly well. But then I'm not sure what happened to it after that. I didn't particularly note seeing it happen that much for the rest of the game, but I thought that that was something that was working pretty well for them and could provide sort of a hybrid solution as teams get more aggressive about rotating a guy to Ibaka. Because once you get into the middle and you're sort of near the paint, that's when, you know, you make teams make mistakes defensively.
So, you know, it's still to a degree the same problem that Oklahoma City has had forever, is they have, you know, too many guys on the floor that you don't need to pay attention to. And it, you know, it, that I feel like so much of kind of the clunginess of their offense comes down to the fact that, you know, Westbrook and Durant are going to have the ball a lot because who else is going to have the ball? And they're going to be staring at multiple defenders because there's going to be guys that you kind of are willing to concede shots to. And if you're you know, a Thunder fan, would you rather, you know, Westbrook try to create against 1.5 defenders, or Durant to shoot over 1.5 defenders, or to have, you know, Deion Waiters, Anthony Merritt Morrow, Steven Adams, Andre Roberson, trying to make a play with the ball?
Right, and I think the issue there is they've never had a true, and this term has gotten so overused over the last couple of years, but I'm going to use it anyway. They've never had a two-way player at that second guard spot between Westbrook and Durant. Everybody they've had has been a one-way guy. Even a guy like Thabo, who's a good shooter, there was just no threat to him offensively. He was never going to put the ball on the floor. He takes a million years to actually get up his shot. So teams felt comfortable ignoring him. You know, they've had guys like that, and then they've had guys like Morrow, who, while they're good offensively, can't hang enough on defense to justify being out there for big minutes. And they have the same thing now with Roberson and Waiters. You know, even if they had a guy like J.J. Redick, you know, who's above average, he's a great shooter, he can put the ball on the floor a little bit, and he's a solid enough defender that you can play him for 35 minutes a night if you want to, that would help them so much over what they've been throwing out there in the Westbrook-Durant era.
And I still wonder how bad Morrow could be.
Right. I think it would work, too. But, you know, this is now the second straight coach that's disagreed, so maybe there's something there that we don't notice.
Yeah. I feel like that kind of, I don't know. This is the kind of point that makes me sound like a know-it-all, so I'm reticent, but it does seem like this kind of the holdover from an earlier era is the thinking that, well, we have enough offense with these guys, so I can put a pure defender there, and then you see that's, you know, the Tony Allen archetype. But, you know, all due respect to Andre Roberson, he's not Tony Allen's level of defender, and so what he's giving up isn't made up for by what he's bringing necessarily.
Right, and now that you just called him Andre, I realized a couple minutes ago I accidentally called him Anthony Roberson. I was thinking of Anthony Roberson, the old point guard for the University of Florida teams back in the day. But
head coach, so there you go.
Let's talk about Derrick Rose. He wound up in this game with 28 points, or 29 points, 5 rebounds, 7 assists. Took him 25 shots and 6 free throws to get there. Had, I believe, 8 points in the fourth quarter, including 3 straight baskets down the stretch to put the game away. What did you think of Rose? Let's start with through the first three quarters, because I think that a lot of the talk of him coming out of the game is going to focus on the fourth, and I have very specific things to say about that. But what did you think of him through the first three?
Especially, we talked about it a little bit, and especially in the second and third quarter, he seemed like he had a little bit of extra burst to the basket. And so he did something that I can't really recall him seeing, and he did on multiple occasions, where instead of really trying to elevate and finish, he went straight line quickly to the basket and almost quick shot a couple layups before any help could get there. And that's kind of a new thing. And if that's a recognition of kind of the days of him, you know, rising up and dunking on people is over, because, you know, physically it probably is, at least with any regularity, then that's a positive adjustment. So that was, you know, that was good for kind of the second and third quarter.
Quickly before you get to the bad, I did notice sort of something similar early in, I think it was the second quarter, where he drove quickly, got his man behind him, and then rather than challenging the big man at the rim, he sort of took like a push floater. He did it actually twice on the same possession, because he wound up getting the rebound, bringing it out, and then doing the exact same thing. Neither one of them went in, but I thought it was an interesting sort of halfway point where he's attacking but not necessarily trying to go over the trees, like you said.
And I, you know, that floater, that's not a shot I necessarily love for most people, including Rose. It's one of those things where it's one of the, if it goes in, it looks like, wow, look at that teardrop, and then you look and you realize that it's a pretty low percentage shot for almost anybody, including Rose. So it's one of those things that looks pretty and at times, but isn't actually that effective. In the aggregate sense.
Right. Just ask Ray Felton. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I couldn't resist. It just had to happen. Let's talk about the fourth quarter specifically with Rose, though. I believe he was 4 for 5 down the stretch. The one miss came when he rebounded his own miss on a drive to the basket and then put in sort of a short floater-ish type shot from like 6 or 7 feet away. The last three shots to sort of give Chicago the lead and put the game away, those will be, I think, what people are largely talking about as Rose having had a great fourth quarter. And man, did I not like any of those shots.
He made 3 pull-up 2-point jumpers in a row. And, you know,
and all 3 times he did it after drawing a big man on a switch.
Yeah.
I'm going to insert the video into the post for this podcast on Hardwood Paroxysm, because I got so frustrated with all 3 shots when I saw them that I had to go back and record the videos. The first time he drew Enes Kanter on a switch and he banked in a step back jumper. Then there was an inbounds pass where he got a switch immediately off the inbounds, saw Serge Ibaka in front of him, and took another 1 dribble step back. And then a couple possessions later, he got Kanter again on a switch. And once again, got a step back jumper over him. I thought it was interesting, and Chuck pointed this out on the broadcast, that once he kept drawing Kanter on switches, Oklahoma City switched Ibaka onto Pau Gasol so they could have him work that switch instead of Kanter. But all 3 of those shots were bad shots from Rose that went in. And if they had missed, people would have been like, that's a terrible shot. Why is he doing that? Go to the basket on those guys. And he actually did it once and got fouled by Kanter. But the 3 jumpers that he took over Kanter and Ibaka, that's the kind of thing that is not sustainable over the course of the season. And I think we've seen that over the last couple of years with Rose. And we'll see it as he continues trying to do it when he draws big men on switches. Our friend Dylan Murphy, who used to write for Hardwood Proxism and is now an assistant coach for the Fort Wayne Mad Ants, wrote about for the mismatch myth, where people think that the true mismatch is when a guard gets a big man on a switch, but more than half the time they just try to shoot a jumper and usually a step back over a taller guy, which is not really what you should be doing. And I thought that was just really bad process that came out with a good result. And, you know, maybe that makes me a hater because we have to celebrate literally every single thing that Derrick Rose does well these days. But, you know, I'm more concerned with him making the right play as opposed to one that works out well for him. You know, MVP Rose was one of my favorite players ever to watch. And, you know, that's, he took some bad shots in those days, but I think he had better decision-making than he does now, especially when it came to things like that. When he would get a big man, he'd always go right to the rim and either blow by that guy for a layup or force him to foul him. And he did that once against Kanner, but three other times that he made jumpers, he didn't. And that was disappointing to see. And, you know, sorry for going on a little bit of a rant there. I'll let you talk about it.
No, I think you covered it perfectly, and I don't think I have anything to add.
Well, that's disappointing. I wanted to hear your take.
No, you covered it well. I think that the one thing to add is that there are some exceptions to the mismatch myth, but those are exceptions. Those are
right.
You know,
Steph Curry can pull up for a jumper,
and Chris Paul,
right,
and you know, guys who will actually start their attack from behind the arc, it becomes a mismatch. And guys, the few guys who are actually good enough at kind of the 2-point pull up, and the few guys is Chris Paul, and I'm not sure who else, maybe Isaiah Thomas.
The thing that those guys do, and you mentioned it quickly, was once they get that switch, they back out, you know, 4 or 5 feet behind the 3-point line, and then get ahead of steam to make that big man take, you know, rather than a half step back, like a full step or even two back, and that gives them so much more space to shoot that jumper, as opposed to having to, you know, step back and fade away and shoot it over the outstretched arms. They're just walking right into it by creating so much space and then stopping on a dime, and it's so much more effective that way. You know, quickly before we end, and this is something that I noted during the game simply because, and we talked about it earlier, they play such similar styles. The Westbrook of today and last year, would you say that is a better player, an equivalent player, or a worse player than 2011 MVP Derrick Rose?
Good question. I think probably a better player.
That's where I fall too, but everyone knows I'm sort of biased in favor of Westbrook. He's my favorite player. That's why I wanted to ask you, who I know you like Westbrook, but not necessarily come down as hard on it as I do.
I think Westbrook does more for his teammates than Rose did. When it comes down to it, you know, for all the talk of his playmaking, Westbrook is a good playmaker, and it may be unorthodox and not like pristine and precise, but it's effective, and so yeah, I think that he does more of that, and I think he's you know, I don't know if he's a, I'd have to look, but I think he's better at drawing fouls. And also he's better at pushing tempo, which for a team that occasionally has problems in the half court, just getting out on the break for Oklahoma City is always a good thing.
Right, and I think like you said, in terms of the helping his teammates more, you know, specifically Ibaka would barely have any offensive contributions without Westbrook. I looked at it a couple years ago, and Westbrook had assisted on something close to like 40% of Ibaka's baskets in his career, which is just insane. And I would imagine the percentages are somewhat similar, even though Ibaka did play a stretch of last season and the season before without Westbrook. He gets so many of his baskets out of that pick and short roll that they ran early on in the game against Chicago, that, you know, that Westbrook just creates by being him and being aggressive going to the basket. And I think that one thing where he creates so much more for guys like Ibaka and even Adams or whoever has been playing that spot next to Ibaka in the front court, that's for me is the difference between him and, you know, as good as 2011 MVP Rose was, that's what makes this version of Westbrook a little better.
I agree. Should we wrap up here?
Yeah, I think that's all we've got. This was really fun, man. We're we're gonna do this every week. Next week, we've got on the TNT games on Thursday is the Warriors at the Timberwolves, and the Clippers at the Suns. Those are two teams that the Suns I'm watching tonight. I have as one of my games. The Wolves I have not gotten yet, but I have them on the schedule for next week. Once in addition to that game. I'm looking forward to both of those. I think it should be fun.
Yeah.
All right, man. Good stuff. Thanks a lot. All right.